1390 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Health Secretary Javier Becerra declared a public health emergency for Texas due to the severe weather that ABC's Zareen Shah has left hundreds of thousands without power.
Nearly 800,000 Houston area residents dealing with sweltering heat without any electricity. The medical examiner in Harris County saying at least three people have died from heat exposure. The power company says they are working around the clock to get power restored by the end of the weekend.
President Biden trying to regain momentum on the campaign trail. He was in Detroit last night. He maintains he is not dropping out of the race, even as more Democrats call on him to step aside. Former President Trump has a campaign event today in western Pennsylvania. All eyes are on his choice for a running mate, which could be announced even before the Republican convention begins. Israel says it struck an area of the Gaza Strip targeting Hamas's military leader. This is ABC News. Jury deliberation began Friday in the federal corruption trial of Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey. Meanwhile, in New York City, police are searching for two men and a woman behind a series of high-end robberies.
Authorities accusing them of targeting diners at high-end restaurants, holding them at gunpoint, and stealing luxury watches and jewelry before speeding away on motorbikes. Eric Goldie says he was held up at gunpoint, the suspects then fleeing the scene with his watch.
He knew what kind of watch I was wearing, just said, Rolex, Rolex, Rolex. Give me your Rolex.
Police are seeking at least two men who are often accompanied by a woman acting as a lookout, saying they've committed at least a half dozen gunpoint robberies in Manhattan and Brooklyn since March.
It's ABC's Aaron Katursky. In a federal appeals court ruled Friday, Tennessee does not unconstitutionally discriminate against transgender people by not allowing them to change the sex designation on their birth certificates. I'm Brian Clark. ABC News.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot.
Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh,
well, that's how the original series was when they moved the camera. Whenever it's like the red alert, the
ear. Right.
Yeah. That was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like.
Right. Lean left. Great. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday nights, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
Busted pencils. Fully leaded education talk.
Our guest, Jonathan Gurko. Deliberative dialogue in democracy isn't winning an argument.
Instead of how do we win and end the conversation, how do we keep it going? How do I listen in a way on the assumption that someone else has something that I can learn from that will improve my point of view so that we can grow? To me, that's the democratic project.
Busted Pencils with Dr. Tim and Dr. Johnny. Weeknights at 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. People have been seeing the stars at the historic Yerkes Observatory near Lake Geneva for 125 years. Now, it's taking on a whole new meaning. Mark Richardson explains.
After the University of Chicago transferred ownership to the Yerkes Future Foundation in 2020, the venue added poet laureates, Grammy winners, NASA sculptors, Pulitzer Prize-winning authors, and composers and artists to the astronomy program. Walt Chaddick, Yerkes Director of Programs, says people are just beginning to get used to the transition.
Yes, we are doing classic observing. Yes, we're doing research. Yes, we have interns and astrophysicists and astrophotographers on staff. We were kind of become this peculiar center that is connecting astronomy to art.
Located just outside of Milwaukee, the observatory has been in use since 1887 and has been used over the years by astronomers, astrophysicists, and other scientists to explore the cosmos. The grounds include the observatory, laboratories, workshops, and libraries, with walking trails around the grounds' 50-acre site. Chaddick says artists have tapped the center's collection of 175,000 photographic glass plates with images of the cosmos.
I've seen people go up to those photographs and go, ugh, modern art. And then they start to read the captions next to the pieces, and they go, whoa, that's a constellation I know.
The observatory has been used by famous scientists such as Albert Michelson, Edwin Hubble, Carl Sagan, and Albert Einstein. The observatory is open to the public Thursdays through Mondays for tours and exhibits. Visiting the grounds is free. Reservations for tours and special events can be made online at yerkesobservatory.org. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Highs in the upper 80s today, lots of sunshine. Showers and thunderstorms possible tonight, a low around 70. Showers and thunderstorms for Sunday, it'll be hot and humid with a high near 91. For Monday, a high near 89 under mostly sunny skies.
Currently, 78 degrees.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey everybody, joining us next time as we're live from Wisconsin Media Row at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee along with Trigvi Olsen. You don't want to miss it. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and yes, I am your host for this, the second hour of our weekend production. Our weekend broadcast here on the stations of Civic Media. Thank you for joining me once again as we consider again this all-important decision coming out of our Supreme Court on July 1 of 2024, changing our Constitution, articulating for the first time in our nation's history the notion that the person to whom we give our responsibility for supervising, directing, executing the law. The Constitution talks about it as taking care that the laws be properly executed, that person has immunity for criminal conduct, criminal acts that he or she may commit while in that office. And that person is different from every other American in our nation. The trappings of criminal prosecution, the basic evidentiary rulings, the understandings about how prosecution goes forward, the things that a prosecutor does and does not do in the course of a trial, all of that altered by this opinion. And as the dissenters have noted so very eloquently, once again, I encourage you to read all of the opinion, including the majority and also the dissenters, but the dissenters especially articulate, especially thoughtful when describing exactly why, in great detail, these particular new principles, never heard before, this new immunity, is indeed going to impact not only this trial, but also the future of our nation. In this hour, I'm going to take a look at those four pending matters. One of them is the election interference case out of which this particular decision derives. It is from that case, that file now pending in front of Chania Chutkan, that the Supreme Court took on this issue about whether or not a president is immune. Now all that goes back to Tanya Chutkan. We'll take a look at the options that she has before her in wrestling with what this all means, making sense of it before the trial gets underway. We're going to talk a little bit about the impact of this case on the Mar-a-Lago prosecution. That is the documents case pending in front of Judge Eileen Cannon in South Florida. What is the impact of this? What has already happened there in the wake of the issuance of the decision, finding that a president has complete immunity when it comes to Department of Justice engagement, but also a presumptive immunity when it comes to virtually everything else that can be overcome only when the government, when the prosecutor shows that that prosecution will not have any impact upon the conduct of this very aggressive and very energetic presidency that is described by this Supreme Court. We're also going to talk about the impact, similarly, of this case upon what Scott McAfee has before him and the likely petitions he will get from defense counsel as they invoke this same order and ask that judge as well to find that that pr- prosecution in Georgia, again, for election interference, should not go ahead on the basis that the immunity applies there as well. Going to be a very interesting debate, motions practice, debate there in oral arguments among the parties, and Scott McAfee certainly having to have to wrestle with the implications of this opinion there. And then we're also going to talk as well about what is going to be, already is, on Juan Merchan's desk. He is the judge who presided over the prosecution that resulted in the finding that Donald Trump did in fact engage in violations of New York state law, false statements, false representations in financial documents and accounting documents, felonies there in that case, in the so-called hush money case, which is actually more of an election interference case as well. Also in connection with the campaign, this one in 2016, all of those cases, all of these files now affected by this immunity ruling. At some point, if it hasn't already happened, Tanya Chutkan is going to be facing this opinion formally returned to her desk. Now it's back in front of her once again. She has before her what is undeniably a daunting task to try to figure out what all of this means, to try to make sense of it, to try to parse through what the Supreme Court has said in its majority opinion when it comes to assessing the 45-page indictment that she has before her. She's got to make decisions about which of its many allegations can move forward and which will have to be tossed out. And there will certainly be some portions of that that in the wake of this Supreme Court opinion have to be tossed out. We've already talked about those specific aspects having to do with the Department of Justice. The court created this peculiar category of things that a president can do, and that is presumptive immunity from prosecution for all official acts. But the prosecutors can overcome that presumption only if they can show that filing charges related to official acts would not result in any intrusions on the authority and functions of the executive branch. That is a very, very high and dramatic standard. I don't know how Jack Smith can possibly overcome that. And yet, that's the thing that Judge Chutkan has to wrestle with now. It remains unclear how much of this indictment will survive, but the Supreme Court has given her some guidance on this, albeit very muddled, very unclear, very unstructured, about how to approach these questions. Let's talk about some of the easy ones and then talk about those things that are head scratchers as you apply these principles in this order to what Judge Chutkan now has in front of her. Let's talk first about the Department of Justice. As we know, not only from our discussion this weekend, but in previous iterations of what this court case said, prosecutors say that one of the ways in which Donald Trump sought to remain in power, that's his motive, we'll get back to that in just a moment, one of the ways in which he's tried to remain in power was by asking two top officials in the Justice Department, their names, Jeffrey Rosen, he was the acting attorney general at the time, and another name you also may recall, Richard Donahue, he was the deputy at that time. And Donald Trump, allegedly in this indictment, asked him to conduct what amounted to sham investigations in basically an effort to validate claims, unfounded, that the election had been affected by some widespread fraud. We know that's not true, but that's what Donald Trump asked. The purpose of those inquiries, both men have said in their testimony to the grand jury, presumably if they ever get the chance to testify, which almost certainly they will not, was to give Donald Trump and Republicans in Congress cover to claim that the vote count had been rigged. When those officials declined to do that, they said, no, Mr. President, we're not doing that, and told them that there was no evidence of fraud. Nothing happened here in 2020. Donald Trump sought to replace him by a loyalist also within the Department of Justice. His name is Jeffrey Clark. He was an associate attorney general, and he was in charge of the civil division. Clark offered to give Donald Trump what he wanted, and that's also in this indictment. He promised to send a letter to the governor of Georgia declaring that the Department of Justice had in fact found some irregularities, things that had happened during the course of this trial, in the election itself, things that had happened, irregularities in this election, and asking the Georgia officials to convene the legislature there so that it could create an alternative slate of electors. We've talked a lot about those fake elector concepts. That's how it was going to be affected in the state of Georgia. In its ruling, the Supreme Court has said that Donald Trump is absolutely immune for all of that. Charges based on those communications, because his discussions with the Justice Department, even about these completely unreal, these phony investigations, unsupported by law and fact, were a part of his core constitutional duties. What does that mean? Here we go. The court's decision has got to mean that Tanya Chutkan has no choice but to get rid of, dismiss that portion of the indictment that regards, that affects, that in any way invokes these communications, these relationships, these engagements with the Department of Justice. Virtually impossible to figure out a substantive way around that. The court's ruling also probably means that Jack Smith, the special prosecutor here, will not be able to rely on testimony from any department officials, including, for example, Rosen, including Richard Donahue, maybe even Clark. None of those officials involved in this proceeding because of the things that the Supreme Court said. And that also impacting dramatically the entire nature of the prosecution, even those things outside of the specific focus on the U.S. Department of Justice. A stunning result, chopping a major portion of the indictment apart. Now, we know that as to the pressuring Mike Pence portion of the indictment, we know, again, alleged in the criminal indictment there, the description was that Donald Trump, again, a part of motive, was intending to stay in power somehow, to keep in position there, by opening this campaign to pressure the vice president, Mike Pence, to try to alter the results of the Electoral College there on January 6th of 2021. In his role as president of the Senate, Mike Pence, the vice president, presided over that final count. We all know that. We all saw that on television. But in conversations with the vice president, also a part of the grand jury presentation here, also a part of the trial, presumably, and with his aides leading up to January 6th, Donald Trump sought to push to coerce the vice president into rejecting those votes, wanted to overthrow that legitimate decision of the people, and as an alternative, to send them back. Let's send them all back to the states for a review of what the Electoral College had and had not done. That's what the indictment says about the vice president. Now, in the Supreme Court opinion, what does Chief Justice John Roberts say? He spends several paragraphs pointing out how intimately presidents and vice presidents work with each other. He says this: whenever the president and the vice president discuss their official responsibilities, they engage in official conduct. And there's the word, official conduct. As we continue to parse through the indictment here, we'll talk about what that means, the implications of what the Chief Justice said for this portion of the indictment still pending in front of Tanya Chutkan, all of that as Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
Are you and your family weather ready?
I'm Terry Barr, producer of the Slice of Wisconsin series. Wisconsin weather is ever changing, and all of us with Civic Media believe awareness can make a difference. Our weather ready stories will offer the information you need. Here's meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
The heat is on. Did you know that high temperatures are the leading cause of weather related deaths? Here are some safety tips when you're dealing with a Wisconsin scorcher. First, do not leave another person or your pet in the car. 8 kids died in hot cars in the last several years across the state, and it didn't even have to happen. Look before you lock and walk away. Work outside, keep water close, and stay hydrated. Take a break in the shade. And if you can limit time in the heat, even better. Chill out in the air conditioning or find your community's cooling shelter. And check on your family and neighbors to be sure that they're safe too. Stay cool and be cool by being weather ready. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, Solar Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking about the applications of this major Supreme Court decision finding that presidents are immune from criminal prosecution. How is this going to play out when Tanya Chutkan takes all of this up in assessing what remains and what does not remain inside the indictment, now back on her desk? This major statement by the Chief Justice: whenever the president and vice president discuss their official responsibilities, they engage in official conduct. How do we read that? What are the tea leaves there? Assertion that appears to suggest that the court's majority believes that Trump should be immune from prosecution for many, if not most, of his engagements, his dealings with the vice president. That is stunning. And we will see. We will see how Tanya Chutkan deals with all of that. He also noticed, that is the Chief Justice, that the vice president's role in overseeing the election certification process, that January 6th event, was not an executive branch function. And the Chief Justice also left another path open for Jack Smith to argue that the allegations against Donald Trump involving these Pence engagements were fair game. He said that as president, Trump had no formal part in the certification at the Capitol. Those are things that Jack Smith will argue to Tanya Chutkan and saying, no, even though all the Department of Justice, those allegations are now gone, we cannot raise those at all. Here, the presumption of immunity should not stand because there are legitimate theories that would support presentations. Tanya Chutkan has to decide whether the Supreme Court left enough of an opening for those portions of the indictment related to Donald Trump and his communications with the vice president to stand. Will those remain? And whatever she decides is all but certain to be appealed again to one side or another. Whatever she decides will go up on appeal from one side or another as this proceeds down the road. Now, there's another portion of the indictment. Again, this is the election interference indictment pending before Tanya Chutkan. In its decision, the Supreme Court, looked at Donald Trump's two efforts to maintain his grip on power together and sort of put him in a catch-all basket, if you will. They both involved attempts to enlist the assistance of state officials in one case and private parties in another. Or as the Chief Justice described it in his opinion, persons outside the executive branch. So we're no longer inside the Department of Justice. We're no longer talking about the vice president. Now, these are people in states and in other places, another major portion of the indictment pending against Donald Trump. Almost immediately after the election, we know, according to what's in the indictment, after that election was called for Joe Biden, he was the winner of that election. The allegation is that Donald Trump undertook a flurry of phone calls. Remember all this history? Remember all this reporting? Meetings with election officials, state legislatures in key swing states like Georgia and Arizona and Michigan. All of those, of course, he had lost the Electoral College vote in those. And the purpose, once again, was to persuade them not to certify the slates of electors that had been pledged to Joe Biden. That was the purpose. Question whether or not any of that purpose testimony and evidence can be presented. They were also working, according to the indictment, again, Donald Trump presumed innocent until proven guilty, also working on a plan inside all of this to create their own slate of electors. They were falsely declaring that Donald Trump had won in the states where he had not. We know that that happened in Wisconsin as well. We know that our attorney general here in the state of Wisconsin has already charged the three architects of that plan here. Our attorney general has not, unlike the other states where fake electors have been charged, our attorney general has not charged the fake electors themselves, but it remains a major portion, that fake elector concept, of the federal indictment. While the position flipped the position of of Jack Smith in this case on their head. The court's majority in its decision in the immunity case seemed at least to entertain the idea that all of these actions of the fake electors were undertaken in some official role of the president to maintain the integrity and the proper administration of justice. Now, Jack Smith dismisses that, and many other people do as well, but maybe it's a theory. And the Chief Justice points out in his opinion that the president, again, has wide latitude under the Constitution to do what? To take care, as I said before, that the laws be faithfully executed. That, of course, in the main opinion of the Supreme Court, including those regarding how elections are run. And he also appears to have the power to discuss an election, even falsely, even to say false things about it, with whomever he wants. This is what the Chief Justice wrote about all that. He said, the president's broad powers to speak on matters of public concern does not exclude his public communications regarding the fairness and integrity of federal elections simply because he is running for re-election. That's what the Chief Justice tells us. The majority, however, did say that, acknowledging that the prosecutor, Jack Smith, has a very different take on all this, and it may well be that this is a matter, once again, for dispute. It will be a matter of dispute in front of Tanya Chutkan. Chief Justice Roberts writes, unlike the allegations regarding these interactions with the Justice Department, those, again, completely immune, those are gone. Those are out of the indictment. This alleged conduct involving the states and other people, he says, cannot be neatly categorized in falling within a particular presidential function. Once again, Judge Chutkan has in front of her this great responsibility then, right? You figure it out, Tanya. You go back to your legal books and you figure out how this falls into a category of whether it can be prosecuted or not. She's got to balance this tension, if you will, between those findings by the Supreme Court and the things in the indictment and the arguments that Jack Smith and, yes, indeed, defense counsel will make about whether all of this having to do with states and fake electors will also be a part of the indictment, the trial going forward, or not. And if she determines, in fact, not, that this also falls away, all of these things a part of the continuing attempts by Donald Trump to carve out, if not dismiss entirely, the indictment against him. Finally, there are all these public statements on and about January 6th. Now, prosecutors, importantly, have not charged this case as a First Amendment case. This is not about his public statements. And they're not alleging that he was inciting violence by those statements that erupted, as we know, at the Capitol later on. That's not charged in this case. But they've signaled plainly that if the election interference case ever goes to trial, they will place responsibility for what happened at the Capitol squarely on Donald Trump. And they intend to do so. Their process, their evidence in this case, is going to be citing public statements that he made on and around before January 6th. You may recall that in December 6th, Donald Trump summoned those followers. We talked a lot about them as well, talking about this is going to be a wild rally. Be there on January 6th. The day itself, he addressed this large crowd at the Ellipse, on the Ellipse, this large crowd of supporters, telling them to fight like hell to save the country. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the implications of that, the evidence in the indictment, and the implications of what the Supreme Court has said on whether or not Tanya Chutkan should permit that kind of evidence and that trial, that component of the trial, to proceed here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark.
Health Secretary Javier Becerra declared a public health emergency for Texas due to the severe weather that ABC's Zareen Shah has left hundreds of thousands without power.
Nearly 800,000 Houston area residents dealing with sweltering heat without any electricity. The medical examiner in Harris County saying at least three people have died from heat exposure. The power company says they are working around the clock to get power restored by the end of the weekend.
President Biden trying to maintain momentum, regain momentum on the campaign trail. He was in Detroit last night. He maintains he is not dropping out of the race, even as more Democrats call on him to step aside. Former President Trump has a campaign event today in western Pennsylvania. All eyes are on his choice for a running mate, which could be announced even before the Republican convention begins. Israel says it struck an area of the Gaza Strip targeting Hamas's military leader. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station.
Want to hear even more? Anytime?
Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
The Brewers upset by the Nationals. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers losing to the Washington Nationals last night, 5-2 to AmFam Field in Milwaukee. The Nationals able to snap a five-game losing streak. Brewers right-hander Freddy Peralta struggled, giving up four runs on 10 hits through five innings. Manager Pat Murphy after the loss.
I mean, I think Freddie made a few mistakes, but I thought generally he threw the ball good. And, you know, they just lost five in a row, so they're kind of hungry to win, and they put some balls in play. And, yeah, and their starter did a nice job to keep us at bay.
The Nationals' Jackson Rutledge held Milwaukee to just three hits on two walks over 4 2/3 innings in his first ever major league start. A familiar face, Jesse Winker, who struggled last year with the Brewers, crushed a home run 403 feet to right center field, his 11th home run of the year. He also drove in a run with an RBI double. Elsewhere, the Cubs beat the Cardinals 5-1 in St. Louis. Chicago's now won five in a row. The Reds got past the Marlins 7-4. Pirates over the White Sox 4-1. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Highs in the upper 80s today, lots of sunshine. Showers and thunderstorms possible tonight, a low around 70. Showers and thunderstorms for Sunday, it'll be hot and humid with a high near 91. For Monday, a high near 89 under mostly sunny skies.
Right now, it's 80.
Hi, this is Jim Schmidt, your former mayor of Green Bay. You know, I've always cared about local issues. I still do. Join me on my new show, Lean Local, here on WGBW. I'll interview community leaders and elected officials, discuss the economy and development projects, and we'll talk about the future of education here in Greater Green Bay. As they say, all politics is local. So join me for Lean Local, Sunday at 1 p.m. on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 WGBW.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 FM and 1590 AM WGBW, and on the Civic Media app.
The Republican National Convention is being held in Milwaukee, and it marks the first time the RNC is in the Badger State. But Wisconsin holds a special spot in the election cycle, with the RNC the second consecutive political convention in Milwaukee. The city was picked for the Democratic National Convention in 2020, but due to COVID, most of it ended up being virtual. Do you know which city has hosted the most political conventions? Philadelphia, Chicago, or Boston? The answer coming up. Political conventions started in the 19th century. It remained the main way to select candidates until 1972, when presidential primaries determined the eventual nominee. Conventions are now considered more of a celebration of the candidate. So do you know which city has held the most political conventions? Chicago. The Republicans have been there 14 times, and the Democratic Convention will be hosted there for the 11th time this summer. 50,000 people expected at the RNC in Milwaukee, a nice slice of Wisconsin for the country to see. I'm Terry Barr. Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
On our next show, we'll check in with Brittany Merlot for a look at the forecast for the weekend. Brian Kuklinski swings in from the Green Bay Rockers.
Then we'll play a round of Who Are You? That'll be fun.
Well, that's debatable. Join us.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. We are looking at the content of the indictment. Penning now back on the desk of District Court Judge Tanya Chutkan. She's got this daunting task. It is huge to try to figure out how you apply this Supreme Court case to what she has got before her as a trial. Part of the prosecution is premised upon these public statements that Donald Trump made. It again, not alleging First Amendment issues. This is not about his ability to speak, but rather laying responsibility upon Donald Trump for the riot that was going on then at the Capitol. Not charging with inciting that violence, but ultimately being responsible for it. And all of that, again, having to do with the things that he said in anticipation, this invocation, this invitation to a wild rally. Be there, he said, on January 6th. And then also on the lips, telling the crowd assembled at that time, go to the Capitol and fight like hell to save the country. Now, the Supreme Court, in its opinion, finding immunities, these presumptive immunities, also throws a wrench in that, if you will, at least for Jack Smith. For Donald Trump, it is a good thing. Suggests along the way that Donald Trump might not be subject to prosecution. Maybe, just maybe, these presumptive immunities apply for things he said during his speech or things he wrote on Twitter, that is the invitation to come to Washington, D.C. Because of this, the majority, Justice Roberts writes, most of a president's public communications are likely to fall comfortably within the outer perimeter of his official responsibilities. What that means is these are the inside things that a president does, in fact, do, official duties and responsibilities. If that's the case, and Tanya Chutkan, after argument from both sides, finds that indeed these statements that he makes, a responsibility for what happened at the insurrection on January 6th, if that is in fact her finding, all of that goes out, not presented at whatever is left of a trial. It's a bit of a footnote to that. Majority also said that prosecutors might be able to base some of those charges on statements that Donald Trump made in his personal role as a candidate seeking office. Interesting, right? And he was that on January 6th, right? And the justices noted there's no clear line between a president's personal and official affairs. And so there is a bit of a linguistic thing on which Jack Smith might be able to hang his hat and his legal arguments. But that is all before the trial judge, Tanya Chutkan. She has got a lot of work to do. How is she going to do that? Well, the indication from the Supreme Court is they anticipate that all this is going to be the subject, as it probably should be, even though it's messy and complicated, of pretrial hearings, not the trial itself, but pretrial hearings, what does and what does not come in. What are called motions in limine, things that will limit testimony, limit evidence, and happens routinely in federal cases, in state cases of a criminal nature. Defense attorneys and prosecutors always come in and say, these are the kinds of things we're going to present, things we're not going to present. And judge, you tell us, are these things appropriate? Are they too prejudicial? Are they the kinds of things we can, in fact, present to a jury? That's the kind of thing that Tanya Chutkan will be focusing on here. The difference is she has got a huge task, and she's got to provide some definition to this concept of official and unofficial acts. She's got to figure out how these notions of motive and intent, all that figures into all of this. Is there anything left there at all? There certainly is nothing left when it comes to communications and engagements with the Department of Justice. What about the vice president? Are those official acts? Were those things done in some kind of a non-official, unofficial way? These are not easy questions. There'll be arguments about them. And once again, what happens after all this is done? It will be appealed. Where does that go? It goes to the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. And we are back again, ultimately, perhaps sometime in 2025, maybe even 2026, before the Supreme Court once again, that will have to determine whether or not the lower courts got it right. We've got a lot of work to do, a lot of things on our palate, if indeed this case goes ahead at all again in a political arena. An awful lot of indication from Donald Trump himself that if he is elected president, this case and, again, the Mar-a-Lago case will go away. Why? Because he will direct his attorney general. He will direct the Department of Justice that he is responsible for ultimately to dismiss those cases. The Supreme Court now telling us that while even if that is viewed in some way as an improper act, it's probably not criminal. But whatever it is, the president's completely immune. You can do those kinds of things. You can engage in criminal conspiracies with the Department of Justice, and you can get away with it. Once again, exactly the kind of thing that deep-sixed the presidency of Richard Nixon, now justified 50 years later by a Supreme Court that does not, in fact, recognize this notion that the rule of law applies to everybody. The decision by the Supreme Court, of course, also applies to another federal case, and that's the case involving Mar-a-Lago, the documents there seized during that search warrant in August. And again, as we all know, the judge there, her name Eileen Cannon, has been slowly, very slowly deciding a number of pretrial motions as well. On just this past week or so, she postponed a few more deadlines in this classified documents case, basically to allow the prosecutors there for some time to respond to this very issue. And that is Donald Trump's request that the immunity decision now be applied to him in this Mar-a-Lago case. They're saying, Judge, look what the Supreme Court just did. It found that the president is immune from prosecution. It should apply here as well. And indeed, the lawyers for Donald Trump have asked Eileen Cannon for permission to file additional papers to bolster, to encourage that notion that this immunity rule, this new concept set forth in this opinion from the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., does in fact apply to the Mar-a-Lago prosecution, and that the wide protections granted there in that case, in the Tanya Chutkan case in the District of Columbia, also apply to the Eileen Cannon case, the case presided over by her having to do with Mar-a-Lago documents. And the lawyers in particular have asked Judge Cannon to put the documents case almost entirely on hold now until she grapples with this question of immunity. Many other things, as we know, have also been the subject of slow movement by her, including how to handle national security documents, all sorts of other things related to jury instructions that she has variously proposed and then withdrawn. She has plainly postponed deadlines before, but this one now, once again, postponed while she can entertain this notion, this argument, that the immunity decision by the Supreme Court also affects the Mar-a-Lago case. And, of course, there's a significant distinction between the two. An awful lot, if not all, of the opinion by the United States Supreme Court affects what? A sitting president, someone who is in the executive branch, in the Oval Office, in the West Wing at the time that these crimes are committed. Here, of course, in the document case, Jack Smith's proposition, principally in the indictment there against Donald Trump and two others, by the way, Donald Trump not just charged with the documents themselves, but also with obstruction of justice along with a couple of other people, attempting to prevent the government from learning more about that entire case. The allegation there, however, is that principally after the presidency, after Donald Trump left office on January 20th, he took with him these documents that he should not have had, kept them at Mar-a-Lago, maybe even in New Jersey, that Bedminster event that we've also heard about. He had those documents improperly. They asked for them back. The archives did. Multiple attempts by letters, by subpoenas. They didn't come back. Ultimately charged with an intentional taking and keeping of those documents. But all of that in terms of timing after his presidency. There may be a very significant, there should be a significant argument that the immunity decision in the Trump versus United States case in Tanya Chutkan's lap right now should not apply to the Mar-a-Lago case. And yet, it is fairly clear that the defense attorneys, which is what they should do, defense attorneys should raise all the issues. That's a part of our system, a part of our process. Defense attorneys almost certainly raising the notion that at least part of the Mar-a-Lago case happened while he was president. He took those documents presumably on or before the time that Joe Biden took the oath of office. Those were already on their way to Mar-a-Lago, maybe other places. And for that reason, the contention may well be from defense counsel that there's enough of a tendril in this matter, enough of a factual predicate in the Mar-a-Lago case that places this still at a time when Donald Trump was president. Now, the question is, does Eileen Cannon embrace that notion? Does she say that's enough of a foothold, that's enough of a toehold, that's enough of a grab, if you will, to bring all of the immunity case inside the Mar-a-Lago prosecution? Or does she say to Jack Smith, no, you're right. This case is about things by a private citizen who happened to violate, according to the indictment, the law, happened to violate this law that prohibits private individuals, including a former president, from possessing documents. That's what Eileen Cannon now has in front of her. And of course, she also has in front of her, depending upon how she resolves that matter, all the other things that Tanya Chutkan is also wrestling with. If she decides that somehow this case, this Supreme Court decision, does or does not in whole or in part apply to the case in front of her, then she's got to address many of the other things. Certainly defense counsel will raise all of the other arguments pending before Tanya Chutkan, also then before Eileen Cannon. A lot to do before a judge who already has a very long docket of other motions, of other pretrial matters that have not yet been resolved. No trial date in that Mar-a-Lago case. We don't have a trial date in front of Tanya Chutkan either, although we've got a plan, plainly, going ahead in front of Tanya Chutkan at some point, at a time perhaps of a pretrial conference in the Mar-a-Lago case in Fort Pierce. And again, at a pretrial conference in front of Tanya Chutkan, some of these scheduling issues should be addressed. Unlikely, from my sense, that either one of those federal judges will set a trial date. Why? Because there's too much work to do. This has caused too much chaos, as the dissenters have said. There's way too much to address here. It is too complicated. Although, on the other hand, it's not. It just is going to take a lot of time to parse through. And in the end, she's got to make some decisions, Tanya Chutkan. In the end, she's got to make some decisions, Eileen Cannon. Both of them about the future of these cases. Both of those could be appealed. In the case of the Mar-a-Lago case, it goes to the 11th Circuit, goes up to that Court of Appeals, and they will determine whether or not Eileen Cannon got it right in resolving those matters in front of her. It's a lot. It's a lot to take in. And yet it illustrates the dramatic impact that this immunity prosecution, the decision by the Supreme Court, will have as these other cases go forward. We know as well that in the state of Georgia, there is a state prosecution that's in front of Scott McAfee. He's the state court judge. He has also been wrestling with all kinds of things. Most notably, you will recall well that he made this finding that the prosecutor there should not be removed from the case because of this relationship that she had with this colleague inside the prosecution office. But he did find that it posed an appearance of impropriety. So he did not throw her off the case, but said that there was an appearance of impropriety, and that prompted the colleague to leave the prosecution team. That's what Scott McAfee did. That matter appealed now to an appellate court, a state appellate court, there out of Fulton County, and they're resolving that right now, presumably in due course. And then, of course, this immunity decision also potentially impacting that case as well. And we're going to talk more about that exact implication there for Scott McAfee, there for the prosecutor, there for the defense, for Donald Trump, there in Fulton County on that state election interference case as Amicus, a law review, continues.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
This is the story of the one.
As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
As a federally licensed broadcast company, this Civic Media station is required by FCC regulations to accept advertising by all qualified candidates for federal office. We also accept ads from state and local candidates. We do screen announcements from issue groups and PACs and exercise discretion in airing announcements with blatantly false claims or outrageous, unfounded statements. These announcements do not necessarily reflect the views of Civic Media, its hosts, or advertisers, and the source of all issue announcements can be found online at our FCC public file.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Talking all about the impact of this major Supreme Court case on these other pieces of criminal prosecution. We know about the Georgia Trump case in front of Scott McAfee. That matter, although lots of pretrial matters also pending in front of the judge, that matter pretty much suspended while the appeals court there also wrestles with this issue about whether or not the trial court judge properly found that Fani Willis, the prosecutor, can remain on the case even while he described her conduct as establishing an appearance of impropriety. That taken up by Donald Trump and others, pending before the Court of Appeals, that likely to take several months. And the efforts of Donald Trump and others to remove Fani Willis may not ultimately be decided anytime soon. But, it's clear that once that is resolved, the Supreme Court's finding of July 1 that presidents, presumably including Donald Trump, are immune from prosecution will certainly be an impacting thing when it comes to the future conduct of that Georgia case. It's certainly going to inform Judge McAfee's own eventual ruling on a request a motion that's been pending for a long time. It was way back in January that the defense raised this immunity issue in front of Judge McAfee. They already said, you know what? Our client is immune. You can't go forward with this. Even in the state courts, presidents are immune. They already raised this issue. But all sides in that case, and of course the prosecution, there is opposing that. They filed opposing briefs. They're arguing just the opposite, that no, there's no such thing. Well, now we know that there is such a thing by virtue of what the Chief Justice said. And they've all been waiting for this decision to come out as it did on July 1. And when this comes back to Judge McAfee, he's now going to have the same task that many of the other judges have. Certainly Eileen Chutkan and, Tanya Chutkan and Eileen Cannon. All of them going to have this obligation to sort out which of these alleged actions in this case in Georgia coming out of that Georgia indictment, which ones are for which Donald Trump is being prosecuted, which ones of those are official conduct, which count as unofficial conduct under this new regime, these new guidelines the Supreme Court has set, making sense out of all this. He's got the same task of trying to turn the language of this order from the Supreme Court into practical reality in some way. And again, that's exactly the assignment that Tanya Chutkan certainly has. Eileen Cannon may not take it up with quite as much aggressiveness as maybe the others will, but the Georgia indictment, as we know, raises the same kinds of issues again in a state prosecution. So there's that issue as well. Does this apply? Well, the president is immune, right, from these kinds of charges generally. Does that apply to a state Georgia prosecution? We know that the Georgia indictment that was again released by the grand jury back in August charges Donald Trump and many, many other people conspiracies, right, to overturn the narrow election there in the state in 2020. It outlines eight different ways in which those defendants are accused of obstructing the election, including lying to the Georgia legislature about claims of voter fraud and creating these fake electors. Once again, lots of things. You recall as well that call that Donald Trump made to Georgia's Secretary of State. That happened in January of 2021. Brad Raffensperger Donald Trump pressuring the Secretary of State to find enough votes to overturn the loss there. That's also a part of the Georgia prosecution. Many of those things, arguably relationships with Vice President Mike Pence, also implicated by the allegations in the Georgia case. All of that now have to be sorted out as well by Judge McAfee eventually, although probably not anytime soon. And finally, we've got the implications for the case that's already been decided by a jury. That's the case, of course, in which Judge Juan Merchan has presided over this case, brought to trial, brought to a jury verdict, in which Donald Trump was found guilty of these offense conducts involving falsifying records to cover up that hush money payment. Yes, that's right, Stormy Daniels, in the final days of the 2016 campaign. Recall all this, the testimony from Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels and all these others, the jury finding in the end that he did, in fact, violate state law. Well, Donald Trump, again, in that case, has asked the judge, Judge Juan Merchan, who previously had scheduled the sentencing for just this past week, Donald Trump and his counsel have now asked that judge to review whether or not the state court prosecution, the verdict in that case brought to a jury result, should in fact be affected, overturned, dismissed by virtue of what the Supreme Court has now done in the federal case, Donald Trump versus United States. Should that felony conviction now be overthrown based upon what the Supreme Court has said? And specifically when it comes to things about the presentation of evidence that we talked about, these ideas about being able to present evidence of things that are official capacity events to support the allegations of crime related to those. Did that happen during the course of this trial? Well, an awful lot of speculation that based upon some of the trial testimony of Hope Hicks, remember her? She testified about the discussions she had with Donald Trump in the White House after the hush money deal took place. Hope Hicks said after the Wall Street Journal broke the story, she spoke to President Trump about that, talked to him about how to respond to all of this. And a prosecutor actually described her testimony as devastating. That's going to be used by the defense to say, you know what? This is all a part of communications inside the White House. They are subject to the same kinds of things that the Supreme Court has now said you cannot use going forward. Questions, again, in front of Judge Juan Merchan. He's promised a hearing on this. He's promised a sentencing hearing, plainly, in September. And even before that, he's going to resolve that issue. Briefs being filed, arguments being made. We'll hear about those. All of these things, public proceedings, they'll be in the news. We'll be talking about them a lot in September and in the weeks before that, as all of this is argued now in the wake of this major case in at least three, if not four, different cases pending in front of our trial judges. Juan Merchan is the one who, again, has the case that is most immediate, if you will, in terms of something, a major resolution. He's got to decide this case by his own schedule, if he's going to sentence or not in September. As we continue future broadcasts, we will continue to focus upon not only these cases, but all things related to justice, government, and the rule of law in this, our nation, the United States of America. Thank you for joining me this weekend on this broadcast of Civic Media.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, the Republican National Convention gets underway. We talked to Greg Treverton from National Security Leaders for America about the ramifications of a possible Trump second term.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones in your area.
Check 511WI.gov or download the free 511 app to see current road work, closures, detours, and camera views on your route. Wherever your travels take you, know before you go with 511WI.gov. That's 511WI.gov. And remember, know before you go. Always park the phone while driving. Sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.